Blog Talk Radio. Good morning. You are listening to Voices for Justice. I'm your host, Michelle Bart. Today, October 28th, 2009, we get personal with Diane Diamond, a media diva making a difference, one story at a time. Diane will be taking your calls in a little while. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. You can also visit her at dianediamond.net. Diane Diamond began her broadcasting career in Albuquerque, New Mexico. At KOB Radio, she wrote and anchored the morning newscast, and her investigative series on corruption within the local sheriff's department earned her the prestigious Silver Gavel Award from the American Bar Association. In 1976, Diane moved across the country to Washington, D.C. to anchor newscasts for National Public Radio's All Things Considered. In 1980, she became the correspondent for the RK Radio Network, assigned to cover Capitol Hill, the White House, and various Washington agencies. She became the network's national political correspondent and covered the campaigns of both President Ronald Reagan and his challenger, Walter Mondale. Finally making a move into television in 1986, Diane's first TV news job was the flagship CBS station in New York. At WCBS, she earned several awards for covering such groundbreaking stories as the Baby M surrogate mother case. Diane has been at the center of countless news stories. She was the first to report on the story of the rape at the Kennedy compound in Palm Beach, Florida, and to identify William Kennedy Smith as the accused. Her hard-hitting interviews with a number of infamous prison inmates include Pamela Smart, the school teacher serving a life sentence for enticing her high school lover to kill her husband, James Earl Ray, the convicted assassin of Martin Luther King Jr., and Diane is also the only reporter to have interviewed Richard Allen Davis, the convicted killer of Polly Klass. Time magazine cited Diane's continuing coverage of the Michael Jackson story as among the best of 1993. And then in 1998, Diane moved to NBC and partnered with Geraldo Rivera to co-anchor CNBC's nightly newscast, Up Front Tonight. When there is a breaking crime story, you can often see Diane's thoughtful commentary on CNN, Fox News, Court TV's True TV, and Headline News, Nancy Grace, and other cable outlets. From the Kaylee Anthony case, which hits home for many of us, to Michael Jackson, and now the Balloon Boy, when audiences of Entertainment Tonight want the scoop, Diane without a doubt delivers. A journalist, reporter, author of Be Careful for Who You Love, and a media diva, this morning, Diane has a voice for justice and will be taking your calls. Again, that call-in number is 347-838-8622. Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Well, wow. I can't believe you gave my whole resume there. I'm fine. Thank you for doing that, actually, because so many people say, oh, Diane Diamond, that's the Michael Jackson lady. You know, I've had this whole body of work outside of the Michael Jackson story, so I appreciate you telling people that.
Oh, no problem, no problem. Your body of work, obviously many of our listeners know you from the Kaylee Anthony case as well, but yes, Michael Jackson does play a factor, and being that today This Is It is going live on big screens across the country, I suppose that would be a good segue into what actually made more of us come to know you back in the case of the molestation cases. What is your opinion, or if you have one, on the release today of This Is It?
Well, you know, I one of the jobs that I also have is to write for the Daily Beast, www.thedreamwife.com, which is a great internet site. And later today, there'll be a piece that goes up by me that is entitled, Don't Be Fooled, This Isn't It. This isn't it. You know, as he always was a true master at showbiz, when Michael Jackson stood in London in March and said, okay, I'm going to do 10 more concerts, this is it, really, it's going to be my final curtain call, he knew that wasn't true. And his handlers and promoters knew that that wasn't true. He'd already signed a contract to do 50 concerts. No matter, you know, what he complained about later, he had signed a contract to do 50 concerts. And what I reveal in the story is that there was actually a three-year plan, a three-year this-is-it strategy to have Michael tour through London, of course, and then lots of European country capitals, onto Asia. And then in 2011, he was destined to come back to America and start playing concerts here. That was the big master plan. So to even name it, this is it, was kind of specious. You know, it was never going to be this is it, because there's going to be concert, there was going to be concert videos in the big theatrical release, kind of like what we see now, but it's just right. Rehearsal video. There was going to be CD box sets. There's the whole marketing plan. You could buy a Michael Jackson doggy carrier, a hat, a mug, a T-shirt, a pen, glasses, you know. So it was never going to be him just singing a few concerts and then going away, this is it. Never.
The show, have you seen it yet? Or
I have not. I'm on the East Coast, and it came out so late last night. I travel so much, I hadn't bothered to get a ticket, so I'll try to catch it.
I'm finding it that if this is it, the only people that seem as if they're, you know, making a comeback are family and friends that none of us have heard of for many years, such as siblings and of course, Father Joe Jackson. Mm-hmm. What is your take on Joe Jackson?
Oh, I think he's a despicable character who tainted the lives of every one of his 9 children. I mean, I'll be blunt. I can be a very blunt person. I just think he is an awful tyrant. He was a terrible father. I wrote a book about Michael Jackson and what he and his brothers had to endure at the hands of Joe Jackson. And now in Michael's death, it's, you know, for many years after he moved into Neverland, and Michael Jackson was like 30 years old when he finally moved out of his family's home. Right. And he got Neverland, and he was able to make his own decisions about his life and about his daily routine. Not that he was very equipped to do it. He'd never really had an education. None of his brothers and sisters had. But when he moved out and went into Neverland, he really shut out his family. Don't believe the stories that, oh, we had regular family meetings and we were very close. No, they weren't. They just weren't. Michael Jackson's brothers especially always came to him with their hand out, begging him, let's do more concerts. We spent all the money from the Victory concert that we did with you. You have to help us. Please, please, please. Well, this had been Michael Jackson's whole life since he was 5 years old. You know, Michael is the breadwinner. Michael, we have to rely on you, 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 you. So when he got to Neverland, he just shut them all out. And now in death, I find it very interesting, not surprising, but interesting that they're back at the door knocking, so to speak, especially Jermaine. He was going to have a concert in Vienna, and then it didn't work, and it got rescheduled 3 times, and now it's canceled. And they just can't, as a individual, seem to get their act together. And frankly, I blame their childhood on that. They were never allowed to make any decisions. It was always Joe Jackson calling the shots, brutally calling the shots. And in adulthood, they all stood around and waited for Daddy to get Michael to get another concert for him, and Michael would not budge.
He seemed to, speaking of Joe Jackson again, he seemed to have been the first person to come out and start passing allegations. And let's face it, considering the situation of the death and how things occurred, I'm finding it very ironic how Dr. Murray, as well as Dr. Arnie Klein, who just filed a claim against his estate for unpaid services and things of this nature, that everybody's looking for exactly what most likely killed him, which was he wasn't loved, he was used constantly, and to numb that pain of not being loved, he used substance. Am I too far off on that?
No. I think that's a good capsulization. Because he didn't feel loved and didn't feel in his place in the world. I mean, I'm being an armchair psychologist here. I think he let his obsessions take over. And, you know, you can't lock yourself away from the world at large and not allow your obsessions to creep in. And that was for childlike things, children, substances, alcohol, lots of drugs. Michael Jackson, unfortunately, has been a drug addict for years and years. Now, on my website, his fans will write in and say that that's all my fault because I wrote terrible things about him. No.
It's your fault that he took drugs?
Oh, yeah. And it's my fault that he died and I hounded him to death. And, you know, that's such a simplistic thing to think. Michael Jackson's life is what killed Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson killed Michael Jackson. You don't hire a doctor to come and pump you full of anesthesia every night if you're thinking straight. That's something a drug addict does. You know, and we know from the leaked autopsy reports he had at least four different benzodiazepines, which are like Demerol, in his system. So it is a true Greek tragedy. It's a modern day mythical tragedy what we watched with that person and his life from childhood to his death.
And unfortunately, statistically, we're seeing a growing number of celebrities and Hollywood elite that fall prey to exactly what killed Michael Jackson, which is the substance abuse, the drugs, the loneliness, and things of that nature.
You don't have to be a celebrity to have that take a grip.
That is true, too. I read that Elizabeth Taylor had called this This Is It documentary a brilliant piece of filmmaking. Do you believe that if it was true that what they're saying, that doubles were used, that she would have recognized that?
Well, that's a Joe Jackson complaint. Well, that's not my son. They use doubles. They're fooling the people. Sony can't get away with this. You know, look, I haven't seen the film, but I understand, like, there are stunts being done. There's sliding down a banister. There's, twirling around in the middle of flames. And Hollywood uses stunt doubles in quick little shots like that. That's what I'm thinking has happened here. But as for Elizabeth Taylor, I mean, what else is she going to say? Oh, yeah. I didn't really like the film?
That's a good point.
And let's make it clear here. I know I'm always a lone voice in the wilderness going, oh, wait a minute now, let's think about this. This isn't really a film. It is cobbled together clips of rehearsal that I dare say Michael Jackson probably didn't really want made into a movie. Oh, clips of it. It's done in very high quality HD video. So I'm sure clips of it were going to find its way into the final film that mostly featured the concert video, because that's where he would have had the perfect costumes and the perfect pyrotechnics and the perfect dancers. And Michael Jackson was all about perfection. And if he couldn't reach perfection, he didn't want anybody to see it. So I'm not sure that Michael Jackson would have liked This Is It, the movie, the way it has been created now.
Do you think that his children will see it, first of all, and do you think that they're going to be able to overcome everything that people have said about their father since the 90s?
Oh, that's, now you're hitting at my heart. You know, I hope they do see the film. because none of them are old enough to have seen him in his heyday, in his concert, you know, regalia as the king of pop. So I hope they do get to see it.
He did put on one hell of a concert. I've seen him twice. And
yeah,
he was wonderful.
You betcha. And he is a complete, one of the most talented people that we will ever see, which adds to the tragedy of it all. But, you know, will they be able to overcome it? They will never be able to go anywhere where they're not pointed at and whispered, hey, that's Michael Jackson's kid. You know, that's Paris. That's Blanket. Ugh, can you imagine being stuck with the name Blanket as a grown man? You know, that's Prince. That's, you know, so they're never going to not be famous. It's going to be how they are protected in that celebrity cocoon is going to depend on what they become. I hope they all find their own special interest in life, you know, whether it's music or dancing or accounting or teaching or whatever it is, so that they have something to do. This was the, in my opinion,
have a purpose.
Yeah, this is my opinion, the big downfall of the Jackson family as a whole. None of them had anything else. They had nothing else but following Michael out in front, twirling and singing. They were never given an education. They were never given a vocation other than that. So at one point, one of his brothers was working in an auto body shop. One was working at a supermarket chain. Just menial jobs because they had nothing else in their life. So I hope his kids get a really, really good education and go on to be, you know, spectacular human beings.
I ditto that sentiment. Moving from the king of pop to noticed you on Entertainment Tonight the other night following John Gosselin out of out of court once again. And that you were amongst the journalists in their courtroom. Speaking of children, which are near and dear to my heart, and that's why Voices for Justice actually started, you know, now we're dealing with 8 children. You know, is there ever going to be justice for them? And are these parents, you know, speaking the truth, or are they just still bickering, and are we going to see another Christie Brinkley situation?
Oh, yeah, boy, that was brutal, wasn't it?
Christie Brinkley. God.
Yeah.
And it still continues to be brutal, so.
It really is. You know, actually, for Entertainment Tonight, I've been flying back and forth Pennsylvania, Colorado, and the Balloon Boy story. So, you know, I write a syndicated column every week about crime and justice issues, and coming up I'm writing about these two dads that I've been covering, Richard Heaney, the Balloon Boy dad,
mm-hmm.
and John Gosselin, the John and Kate Nate. And it just, you know, let's focus on the Gosselins. Look, they got 8 kids, which is unusual, but they're getting a divorce, not so unusual. There's bickering, not unusual. It's
yeah.
just that our cameras and lots of other cameras are around to watch what happens. Will Kate show up in court? She did not, by the way. And what will John say? And, you know, I feel badly for them because it's, you know, I've been through a divorce. If I had a camera stuck in my face every day I went through something tough on that, oh, man. But they put themselves out there. They are reality TV stars. And so we flock to see what's happening. The difference between the two dads, I think, is, I'm going to go out on a limb here, I really think John Gosselin is trying. You know, I was prepared not to really like him. He's got that girlfriend. He's got the, you know. But then you sit and you talk to him, and he says, well, she has that boyfriend, you know, and we decided to split. And so I got on with my life, and I'm going to therapy, he told me. I want to know how to build a life independent of Kate. He was 22 when they got married. She was 25.
Oh, wow.
25, yeah. So, and he said, mostly I want to go to therapy to figure out how to talk to my kids about what's happening. And
so he is sincere the way he comes off on screen?
Yeah.
That is sincerity?
He really, look, I'm the first one to poke out a phony. You know, I'm not saying he's the Einstein in the group there, but he really does appear to me to be trying. Richard Heaney, the Balloon Boy dad, on the other hand,
oh God,
I think he overthinks everything. And, you know, hey, I got a great idea to get us a lot of publicity, which will in turn get us another reality show, and I'll just throw my kids out there and make them lie to the authorities. And it just, it's a real dichotomy in the way parenting should go.
Yeah, I find it good that reporters like yourself, there's three major cases and many others that, you know, of course we have the Octomom and all of those those folks, but it seems as if in the last year or so children have been prey to their parents' upbringings or hidden agendas. And, you know, of course it happens every day in regular folks' lives.
Right.
But again, you know, they're not under a watchful eye unless, of course, your child goes missing and then your whole world is under a magnifying glass. But in Richard Heaney's case and Michael Jackson and the Goslins and the Octomom and all of this, it seems as if there's children at the helm that are being hurt. And this is our future. And it's like, holy crap, what is going on with this?
And why aren't we doing anything? Why aren't we doing more about it? I agree.
Exactly. Why aren't we protecting them? When you have the Gloria Allreds of the world going out on a limb and trying to do something for the child and have a voice for the child, she gets bashed for it. But yet there needs to be more people, there needs to be more journalists making sure that the child has a voice out of this, because that poor boy throwing up on national television, I think it was the Today Show, that they didn't know what to say, you know, he's thrown up while they're interviewing them, you know, and then you see blogs that the father might have given him some kind of solution to make him sick, you know, and that poor Falcon, you know, it's just sad.
You know, the moment that the little boy Falcon said, you know, why were you hiding? Because you guys said we were doing it for the show. If you look at that piece of tape, look at his oldest brother sitting.
Yeah,
off
he looks right at
left.
His mother.
He looks like,
know?
Holy crap! He just told a secret.
Yeah, we're all in trouble.
To death, we're all in trouble. Exactly. And as I was standing outside the Colorado Fort Collins home of the balloon boy family, a domestic violence worker came up, Rita Smith, a wonderful woman, and she wanted to leave a card at the front door. Because she said, you know, we've all heard that there was a 911 call here earlier in the year. Mayumi Heaney had marks on her face and her eye capillaries were burst. And she, you know, said, there's nothing wrong. And she said, there's obviously something going wrong in that house.
Oh, definitely.
And I want her to know that there's help out here. So, you know, who knows what the truth is. I think that he will probably be charged soon, maybe this week, if not early next week. And I may be back in Fort Collins, Colorado. Who knows?
Well, what's it like to have to be parked outside of a house knowing that these children may not be safe right beyond the door?
Well, that's so frustrating to me. And, you know, every time Richard Heaney came out, I said, I mean, I was there 3 or 4 days. I said, how are your kids? Why aren't they in school? Are you deliberately keeping them out of school? How are they doing? And he wouldn't say a word. On advice of counsel, of course, but that is what I kept thinking, staring at that door, wondering, you know, who's going to come out next, what's going on. They all bustled into the truck at one point and drove away, and I really tried to study the kids' faces to see how they were, and it's heartbreaking. That's
yeah.
The short answer to your story. It's heartbreaking.
It's very heartbreaking. I noticed on TMZ.com they had a photo of Richard Heaney about 10 years ago with Bradford when he was an infant, smoking putting a cigar in his mouth and an empty bottle of beer and taking his picture.
Oh,
and of course, we've all seen the video footage of the woman bashing and the gay slurs and things of that nature that this father had put these children up to. And I say that loosely because, you know, as an adult, you know, if you're Michael Jackson, you have control over what goes in your body. You're an adult. You know, you have a choice to say no. But children think their parents are God, and they're going to do what their parents are putting them up to. Right. And, you know, it seems as if this goes back a long time before the UFO took off from Colorado. And,
yeah, and a lot of American families, unfortunately. And you know,
that is true.
The New York Times just did a front page piece about runaways. And the fact that there are 1.6 million children reported as runaways every year, and most go home. Most go home after a week. But there is a group that doesn't go home, and they live on the streets, and they turn to prostitution ultimately because they have to feed themselves, so they sell themselves. And we just don't do enough about it. I wish I was smarter and I could figure out a way to do more about it. There's a pilot plan in Dallas, Texas, where they really work on the kids when they bring them in from the street. And instead of treating that 14-year-old girl or boy as a prostitute and throwing the book at them, they treat them, rightfully so, I think, as a victim. And they get them in the system and they try to break them and say, who's your pimp? And go after the pimp and go after the adults instead. It's a real switchback into the way we have been doing it, which and why would you throw a 14, 15-year-old girl in prison for prostitution? She is obviously a victim. Where are her parents? That's the criminality that's happened. The parents that aren't taking care of them, or the mother who's allowing the boyfriend sexual access to her children, and so they leave. So I don't think until we switch our attitudes in this country. You know, Congress had the money to pay for these kind of programs like Dallas is doing, but they didn't quite pass it. They got in a fight about something else, and they just forgot to pass that $50 million for programs like this. Well, we're living with the result now.
I'm a member of Seroptimus International and have been for 15 years, and coming up in January, I'm the chairperson for the Human Trafficking Conference for the Northwest Region, and I'll tell you, when I look at what these kids are going through, many people think it's a choice. And as somebody pointed out clearly the other day in a convention, who would make a choice like that?
Yeah.
You know, these people are forced, no matter if your name is Falcon and you're six and you're forced to get in an addict or you're forced to go on the street and be pimped out. It's definitely a crime all the way around, and that brings me to my next question. Have you had an opportunity to review the Sarah Cruzan case? I believe somebody posted on your Facebook also, but that was that case I was discussing with you in California.
Yeah, no, I have not, and I wish I had. I've been just too few hours and too much work. You know, tell me about it though.
Sarah Cruzan was kidnapped at 11 years old by a man, and for 3-4 years she was pimped out. She was trafficked more or less. She was abused physically and mentally, and was battered constantly and raped over and over again by her pimp. Nobody would do anything throughout the years to help her. She tried, and Senator Yee in California is trying to take a stand on this because she took the law into her own hands. Is that justice? It's a bittersweet justice in my estimate, but she killed her pimp, and now she's serving a life sentence without the possibility of parole at the age of 16.
Oh,
and so, you know, is that justice? You know, did she do something wrong? Yes, she took the law into her own hands. I don't condemn that, but I do not think that she should be utilizing space in our system where pedophiles need to be being put there instead.
Now, where was the gap? What happened to the, quote, safety net? How did she reach out for help and didn't get it from where?
I'd have to look at the file again. I just, I know that I noticed on Facebook somebody had posted that same exact case on, I think, your wall or something, but that was the case I had mentioned to you a few weeks ago, because it's heartbreaking, because we do so much in Soroptimus for Best for Women and trying to protect the rights of women and girls, and this young lady is kidnapped and had her the way with for, you know, 3-4 years, and then, you know, she kills the guy, and now she can't get out of jail ever. I find that something's wrong with that picture.
Well,
we'll learn more from Senator Yee's office, and maybe we'll have him on. But I encourage you to look at that case because, again, you know, there's no justice to that factor. And I would think that cases like that, cases like the balloon boy, forget the fact that his father is an idiot. You've got, and that's an understatement, you've got, you know, the boys, you've got the children, you've got John and Kate Gosselin's 8 children, Octomom's 14 children. And, you know, as a journalist, does this, do your emotions ever get the best of you?
Yeah, they do, but not on the air. you know, you have to be pretty controlled if you're holding a microphone and a camera's standing in front of you. But, yeah, there are lots of times when you come home, and you mentioned that I had worked on the Baby M case, that original surrogate mother case way back when. I used to come home after covering that trial way back then and think, you see what happens when you mess around with Mother Nature? You want a baby, and instead of just adopting a baby somewhere, you got to hire a woman to carry her egg, but not your sperm, but not your wife's egg, because she has MS, and you can't, you know, stop it. It's like puppies. There's enough puppies to go out and adopt. You don't need to make more children via surrogate parents. But yeah, it does get to me, and if I cover a long-standing trial, it gets to me more, because then you get all of the information. If I had covered the trial of Sarah Cruzan, which I wish I could have, I would be emotionally invested in it. How can you not be? You know, never believe that phrase, objective reporter, because we all bring something to the table. We bring our life experience. I mean, I have a daughter, you know, so I'm going to bring my motherly stuff to the table. If, you know, you're a gay reporter, you might bring that agenda to the table when you report on things. If you're black, if you're Hispanic, you know, so we all, you know, let's remember, we're all human beings first. But for me, there's nothing more sacred than being a parent. And when you screw that up, not only have you hurt yourself, but you've hurt generations. Your kids, their kids, their kids.
That is true. That is true. To our listeners, I know I see a lot of folks in the chat room. Feel free and call in. We had a caller on the line. Call back. The number is 347-838-8622, and Diane would love to take your calls. What has been the hardest case for you to do in all your years of journalism?
It has to have been Michael Jackson. I mean, I hate to, you know, dominate the airwave here this morning with just that story, but It started for me in 1993 when I worked for the TV show Hard Copy, and we broke the story that there were police at Michael Jackson's door, and why were they there? I was tasked with figuring it out. I'd never done a celebrity story before. I was a crime reporter. I'd covered politics in the White House, you know? So I never went after it as a celebrity story. I went after it as a, has a crime been committed here story. And since 1993, I have to be honest with you, every time I dip my toe back into the Jackson story, my life turns upside down. His former private detective, Anthony Pelicano, had tapped my phones. I was being followed. I had to have bodyguards go to and from work with me. My house was vandalized. I worried for the safety of my child. You know, it was bad. And then I put the story down for several years until 2003. I got a phone call from a source who told me there was another boy, and there was going to be a trial this time, and there was going to be a raid at Neverland. And I had to, I really had to think long and hard about whether or not to get back into the story, because I didn't need fans coming to my home and writing on my website, and, you know, but I did it. I got back into it, and then, of course,
you still stand your ground on everything that we know you have reported on the both cases in 93 and 03?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And I covered the every day of the trial, and I excuse me, wrote a book about it, and I wish my publisher, Simon & Schuster, would let me go in and write another couple of final chapters, but they went ahead and reissued the book without that. They wanted to get it out there quickly. I think over the years, what I have learned is more about not just the facts. You know, they're cold, hard, ugly facts in this story, but more about the psychology of Michael Jackson and what made him do the things I believe that he did. And I think that that's missing from the book, because I wanted to be factual. I wanted to just talk about what I could prove and what trusted sources had told me. And so I'd like to go back. Maybe I'll write an extra chapter or two and put it on my website, dianediamond.net.
That should, I would take, I would advise you to make sure that you have enough backup and space
yeah.
on your website. That might crash it a couple times.
Well, that's happened since his death. Yeah.
And that happened 5 times with the Kaylee Anthony case, and still to this day, even we started our blog talk radio, Voices for Justice, with the forensic evidence that's lacking in the autopsy report, amongst other things, on the Kaylee case. And we had thousands and thousands of downloads. And luckily for us, our folks at Blog Talk Radio can handle that. Her website never was able to. So, but what has been your favorite case over the years with everything that you do?
Oh, that's easy. There was a woman named Catherine Bartholomew who I was living in California, and I like to read newspapers. I'm sad that they're going to be going away in my lifetime, but I was reading a paper, and I saw a little tiny article that said something about three women who worked in an office found a homeless woman in front of a market. And she seemed to be sort of incoherent and in need of a place to clean up and rest and eat. And they took her home. And the Angels baseball team in California was honoring these three women for being angels.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I went down and I met Catherine Bartholomew, and it turned into a whole documentary type program that I did. And the bottom line was she had amnesia. She did not know who she was.
Oh, wow.
And I got to work. I found some clues. I followed them. It took me a long time, too, but I finally figured out that Catherine Bartholomew had diabetes, and she had had some sort of an episode while living on the street. The year before she was out, she had done the software program for the Los Angeles Times.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, she was a smart woman. She had been in the military. She had military benefits waiting for her. She had a pension. She had so I put her together with the local VA down there in Orange County, California, Rancho de Santa Fe, I remember, and they got her hooked up. Once we found her identity, they got her hooked up with the proper VA people who got her into a hospital, got her evaluated, got her back on her insulin, and ultimately, when I found her, she had been living under a freeway with a golden retriever dog, Sadie. And Sadie saved her life several times from unscrupulous people who tried to take advantage of her. Ultimately, we got Catherine reunited with her family back in Nebraska, and we put Catherine and Sadie on an airplane, and they are living happily ever after back in Nebraska.
Oh, what a beautiful story.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
So,
how long, when you do a story like that, you said it takes a long time. How long is a typical story? We know reporters on a daily basis, you know, you might see them on three different stories within 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
But how long does a story take to put together? And are stories like the Michael Jackson case still unraveling every day?
Oh, yes, they are unraveling every day. There's always layers and layers to a story every time you talk to somebody new. But, you know, my easy answer to that is there are lots of different kinds of reporters. And when you turn on your local news and you see a reporter standing on a roadway saying, this is where the accident happened today and three people died, that's a spot reporter. They go out, they may cover two or three things in a day. I know as a local reporter here in New York, I would sometimes get two or three assignments a day. You know, get there, go live, hurry up, go fast. There's no time for any in-depth. You're doing who, what, why, where, when, period. So that's one kind of reporter. Then there is an investigative reporter who we get to take some time with stories. When I write a blog, a column for my syndicated column, or I write a long piece for the Daily Beast, I can have worked weeks and weeks on it, sometimes years. I just wrote a piece for the Daily Beast not long ago about Michael Jackson's original plastic surgeon, a man named Dr. Stephen Hofflin. Well, I've been hearing about Dr. Stephen Hofflin since 1993. So I picked from all of my memories from back to 1993 to write about him today. So sometimes, you know, they say, oh, those old reporters, get them off television, get them, you know, retire them. Yeah, but we're the ones with the memories. We're the
exactly.
ones with the experience. We're the ones that can provide the perspective and the depth. Let me tell you about Stephen Hofflin. You may not know that name, but you should know that name because he's the first one who ever carved up Michael Jackson's face. And I have that.
The plastic surgeon you're speaking about.
Yeah, yeah. So it's it just depends on what type of journalism you are practicing on any given day.
On any given day. Now, as a journalist, we all know that many reporters like yourself do travel quite extensively. How often do you see home?
I'm sitting in my home office right now watching the colored leaves fall in my backyard. I've been home for, let's see, when did I get home? I went to Pennsylvania on Monday to do the John Gosselin story, so I've been home two whole days now.
Well, that's why we chose 6 a.m. I figured if you were home, it would be better for you to get up at 9 instead of 6 a.m. out here on the Pacific Coast. But
right. Entertainment Tonight, of course, is based out in Los Angeles, so after Michael Jackson died, for example, and they brought me on, I lived out there for like 13 straight weeks. So
yeah, you were out here a while.
Yeah, I was up every day at 5 a.m., so we could have done it anyway.
You were actually in the midst of the fires, if I can recall.
Yes, yes. And, you know, my husband and I lived in Los Angeles for most of the 90s, and we'd experienced those fires before, but I was standing in my hotel window looking out at this ridge of fire coming over the ridge. It was scary.
It is definitely scary, and I always commend the firefighters, the men and women that really battle those. I lived there for 17 years until moving to the Northwest, so it definitely is a beautiful country as long as it's not all lit up.
Right, exactly, and on fire.
When you're traveling, do you ever worry about what happened with that sportscaster reporter in hotels? That was one of the questions somebody emailed me last night. And
you mean taking the nude video? I don't think.
Yeah, or being watched in hotels and things of that nature, because you know you never really thought about that until all of a sudden that news story broke.
Well, you guys might not have thought about it, but I did. I sort of operate like a private investigator, and for example, I will never leave anything in my car face up that has my name on it. I drive rental cars. If I'm in a same place for a long time, I will change rental cars. I never throw anything in the hotel trash because that can be retrieved. I don't write on the hotel pads because you will leave an imprint of your, you know, just pressing down on the pen or the pencil. I never leave my room unless if anyone else is in the hallway. I don't get into elevators alone with any one person. You know, there are just ways that I live my life that you might not think about, but
are these,
I do it.
Are these things that you do based on what, you know, what's happened to you in the past while doing the Michael Jackson case, or are these things that
exactly.
you've just always done?
No, it's stuff honed for many years. I walked out of the Paramount lot in Los Angeles, Melrose Avenue, Gower Avenue, in 1993 after breaking the first Jackson story. And I calmly walked out of the door one day, the office, the lobby, and crossing the street to go get my car, and I was completely surrounded by this group of Michael Jackson fan club people. And roughed up, not hurt, but just, you know, it's like, what's going on? Who are these people? Oh, my gosh, it finally dawned on me. So I don't step out of a door until I look both ways. It's like, you know, car at an intersection, because you never know. And it's not just Michael Jackson fans. I mean, I do a lot of work with just investigating crimes and frauds and con men. And a lot of criminals think, oh, well, I could just get rid of her and my problems will go away. Well, that's when your problems begin, of course. But I don't want to become a problem, you know. I don't want to put myself in a problem situation. So,
And back then in the 90s, the people that surrounded you would call themselves protesters. Today they'd call themselves bloggers.
I would call them zealots.
You know, recently the situation with Cindy and George Anthony in the beginning of that that particular case, those folks that were out in the front of their yard, you know, if you have a purpose, make sure it's known. You know, protesting, make sure you have an objective. You know, otherwise you're known as a gang in my book. But you've been on shows like Fox, and you've worked with the likes of Geraldo and Mary Hart, and congratulations to Entertainment Tonight, by the way, because I remember when they debuted, and folks, you know, and critics alike were saying that that show would never make it, and it's going strong all these years later. What's it been on the air, almost 30 years?
30 years. They just, Mary Hart has been there 30 years, and I think the show is actually like 32 years old. But Mary, I got to tell you something. There is no nicer person in television than Mary Hart. She is, I think we get along because she's from South Dakota. I'm from New Mexico. You know, we're not seeped in the Hollywood or New York milieu, you know, and she's just the nicest person.
She is nice. I met her at an event many years ago, and she definitely is everything she appears to be on television.
Yeah.
Even for those million-dollar legs, listeners may not know, but her legs were insured for $1 million when that show first started. So
by Lloyd's of London, yeah. And can I tell you how intimidating that is when they sit me on the set in L.A. next to her wearing a skirt? I look at her, I say, Mary, this is, like, not fair. Can I go put on some slacks? But she laughs. She is a wonderful, genuine human being.
Definitely, and the folks up here in the Northwest, we're happy to have the likes of John Tesh, who used to be her partner there for many years, and his wife Connie, and they do a lot of good in the Northwest as well. You mentioned, pardon me?
He's a great guy, John Tesh.
He is a wonderful guy, and if folks tune into his radio station, you learn quite a bit at night when you're listening to the John Tesh show. So, you had spoken about concerns when you're, you know, walking around and being by yourself, etc. on the case that you won the Silver Gavel Award from the American Bar Association on the corruption of that local sheriff's department, did you ever have to deal with backlash from law enforcement and police in that situation?
Well, my side, that was back in the days where there were wing windows in your car, was shot out.
and
that was a little spooky. I wasn't in the car at the time, but, you know, you come out and you find a bullet hole in your windshield or your window. It's a little sobering. I was a very young rookie reporter when I started covering that story, and it culminated in the sheriff and his three top aides going to prison. And they had misused federal funds. They had checked female prisoners out of the penitentiary and brought them to the sheriff's home to stay for the weekend. Wink, wink. They had flown the county plane to Mexico for vacations. And, I mean, there were a lot of wrong things happening there. But let me tell you what occurred. I won an award for that series of stories we did. But the sheriff committed suicide.
Oh, wow.
And I have to tell you, as a young reporter, when that happened, that was very sobering for me. That taught me very early on the power of the press. And this was a sheriff who had been the sheriff and then not the sheriff. And, you know, you couldn't keep the term for more than 4 years. So he had switched off with another sheriff. And we'd had these two sheriffs for like 30 years. And it wasn't my fault that he was a criminal. I did expose him, but that's my job. And it took me a long time to convince myself I was not responsible for that suicide. He was responsible for that suicide. He put himself in that position. He violated the trust of the voters. But I've never forgotten that lesson. And I know when I report things that are damaging to people that it's going to hurt them. But you know what? I didn't start the hurt.
Exactly. And I think a lot of people, you know, I've been on both sides of the microphone, and I'll tell you that, you know, turning my marketing and public relations company to helping folks of families of missing children was an eye-opener for me, to say the least. But in doing so, you know, you also see a different side of media, and you know that things have to be put on because it sells airtime, it keeps viewers attached, and things of that nature. Do we always agree? No. You know, you have to agree to disagree in this business, but without the media, you know, I'm the biggest advocate for media, because without all of you, these stories wouldn't come to light. Without Larry King and CNN breaking that family on national television, we may have never known that that was a hoax. I'm sure, you know, good reporters and journalists like yourself would have broken it sooner or later. But, you know, cases like that, or the William Kennedy Smith case in Palm Beach, those kind of cases, we would never know. You would never, ever, ever know what was happening, and it will be a secret, you know, that they die with. But certain secrets need to be made public. And again, everybody has a secret, you know, and it's just a matter of when it comes to light and why it comes to light. But you can't crucify the reporter for it. That's their job.
Right.
Do we always like it? No.
Yeah.
You know?
Can you imagine life without public information? Now you're
exactly
talking about China. You're talking about communist China, or communist Cuba, or the old days in Russia, or maybe some of the days in Russia right now. But, you know, I know how the game is played, because I've been in it a long, long time, and I know it's all about ratings and sponsors, and I know that. But my motivation in what I do, Michelle, is truth. And telling stories about human behavior and why we do the things we do to each other. What is behind it? Why in the world would Richard Heaney get his kids to lie to federal authorities about a balloon? You know, why would Michael Jackson keep inviting children into his house long after he's suspected of molesting them? why does the Octomom decide to go ahead with all those babies? I mean, did she not think ahead? And until we can, I think, that until we can really talk about these stories and analyze them, then it's just foolish not to. This is what's happening around
and
us.
And cases impacting not only the families at the helm of things and then the reporters and so on and so forth, but I think I can speak for most anybody that was tuned in to all the cable networks and the local, even the local media, for God's sakes, were covering the Balloon Boy story and how everyone's heart dropped when that balloon finally came down and Falcon wasn't there.
Yeah.
And how we all felt emotionally, how our world stopped, just like, you know, when you're sitting in a classroom, as I was, and our home ec teacher lost to Christina McAuliffe on the space shuttle. She was second in line to be on that shuttle when it blew up in midair, and we had to look at her, and we all cried with thankfulness it wasn't her. And all of those emotions that come with these stories that are seen, and then reporters stating, see the basket, it fell, we need to find it, you know, that takes on a huge toll, and that goes beyond the reporting. That would be a Dale Archer or a psychologist question, because that, I can only say how I felt, and I'll tell you, my heart just dropped, and I could not leave the television screen all day until I found out where that basket was.
Well, see, now you have just identified why we reporters do what we do, because in this 24/7 atmosphere we have now, you get to see exactly what we see as we're covering a story. And all of the machinations that go through our head. Wait, there's no basket. Where's the basket? Did he fall out? Wait a minute. Maybe he wasn't ever there. Maybe there was no basket. And it's kind of like watching sausage being made. It can get kind of confusing and ugly sometimes. But it used to be we'd come home and watch, you know, Walter Cronkite or Tom Brokaw give you the news at the end of the day after everything had developed and you knew the whole story. Now you get to live it like we live it. You know, we're calling our news desk saying, oh, my God, there's no basket now. What happened to the basket? But instead of calling the news desk, we're saying it live on the air.
And it's obviously impacting everyone's life. We have some folks in the chat line that's saying India, D.C. is saying, thank you, Diane Diamond, for what you're doing. He's been a big fan of yours for years.
Oh, thank
and
you.
It's been a very emotionally wrenching. The Henny should be ashamed of themselves. And then another comment was Mr. Jackson's situation is tragic, but again, it was and has been his own fault. And for the most part, that's all we can say. I'm reading Jane Velez's book, I Want, and I'll tell you, in that book, the prelude states, I hope we can walk this path together, and now I see why she said that, because when you start reading that book, and I'm only on like chapter 2 or 3, it hits home that we're all the same. We bleed the same blood, you know, and if you don't have morals and values, such as life, but with reporters, it's, you know, you all are doing it because it's your job, but there's a story to be told, and whether it's good or bad, it needs to be told.
Well,
and
I believe
nobody can blame themselves. Nobody can blame a reporter but themselves for what they've done and put themselves into.
Well, if we get it wrong, then blame us. But, you know, I believe this is what motivates me. There's good and evil in the world, and I want to report on it because we won't know what good is until we recognize evil. And that's what motivates me every single day. So, I see we're running out of time, but I hope everybody comes and visits me on my website, DianeDiamond.net. and I post my syndicated column there every Monday. It goes out across the country on Saturdays. But then they
and we've also
posted it
on Blog Talk Radio as well. So
thanks, thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank you, Diane, for being with us today, and thank you to the listeners. Our next show is next Wednesday, November 4th. We're going to explore the Amanda Knox case. Attorney Ann Bremner, Dr. Dale Archer, and forensic expert Larry Kobolinski will be with us. What are you doing to make a difference? Are you a voice for justice? Have a happy and safe Halloween, and we'll meet again here next week. But remember, you too can be that voice for justice, so speak up and make a difference. Thank you, Diane, and thank you to everyone who listened.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye.